Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Right, day two at the O2 Arena, the ATP World Tour Finals has come to a close. Two matches played in the singles, two matches played in the doubles. Novak Djokovic has just beaten John Isner and was imperious. Don't ask me for my verdict on it. Let's ask two people who know far more about it than me, in the form of Charlie Eccleshare from The Telegraph, and a huge warm welcome to Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Hello, guys. Great to be back on the Tennis Podcast. Yeah, we've previously been on a few years ago.
Yeah,
so
we've just established that you were on before. It was so memorable, you didn't remember it.
I have to admit, I did think it was my debut, so but great to be here nonetheless.
Yes, indeed. You've just been here as a fan, haven't you? Just as a ticket holder.
Absolutely, yeah. I got my ticket in my pocket, which I think is always nice to experience an event in that way. You know, we're very privileged as people that work in the tennis industry to turn up to these kind of events, and the tendency can be to take them for granted a little bit. But to come in on the tube and use my ticket and go in as a fan and just experience the event is it's good. Gives you a different perspective and makes you remember that's what it's about. You're selling a show at the end of the day.
And I seem to remember, which year was it? Were you and Ross Hutchins, were you alternates here? Is that right?
Yeah, we were the doubles alternates in... now you're really testing me.
See, yeah.
I'd forgotten I made my debut on this, so how am I going to remember that? You know, so I think it was 2012, actually. Which is a significant year because it was the end of that year that Ross, unfortunately, was diagnosed with his illness. So
yeah.
Great, obviously, to see him do so well and having been with him all last week as he's the tournament director in Milan. So
yeah.
what a success he's been since finishing the tour, which is great. Obviously, significantly biased as one of my best pals as well. But so it was 2012. I think we finished 10 in the race. I can't remember who finished ninth, but they didn't come as alternates, so we came, and it was a fantastic season. Yeah, it was great to kind of achieve that, if you like, even though we didn't quite get to play, but great to be here.
Yeah, quite an amazing place to watch tennis, isn't it? I mean, you've just been in the crowd. What is it like as a sort of spectator experience?
It was good. It was good.
You're not so sure.
Well, I think a lot in tennis depends on the match that you watch, you know, it was pretty one-sided. I don't think anyone, you know, any of us can disagree. It was a little bit one-sided. In terms of the show they put on, it's spectacular, isn't it? With the build-up and the walk-ons and the light show and the music and the, you know, they do a great job of that. But, you know, Novak Djokovic was incredible. So good tonight. Just gave Isner absolutely nothing. The way he was returning the serve actually was we were at the side of the court, so I took the chance to just keep focus on Djokovic for quite a few points. It looked to me like he was reading Isner's serve. He was making a move before the serve was being hit, and just the way he returned was it's mind blowing, really, in the way he moves as well. But it was good.
Right, well, we're going to get on to why Conan is not absolutely emphatically impressed with the entertainment in a moment or two. But let's just ask Charlie, what did you make of the Djokovic performance last night against a guy? I was reading you, Isner, 6'10". He hit 13 aces tonight, and 69% of his first serves went in. and he lost 6-4, 6-3.
Yeah. I mean, the way Djokovic was playing, it looked as if he was taking about 30 miles an hour off Isner's serves. He was making them look like sort of 100 mile an hour, 110s, when they were absolutely flying at him. His anticipation, he was just taking it away from Isner. And Isner looked, you know, he actually picked himself up well in the second set, I thought, because the first set was brutal. You know, every game was a break point, more or less. I think all but one. In the second set, Isner did at least start holding his serve, but you always felt Djokovic was going to lift it. And he just looks so liberated right now. He just looks like he's having fun. He's enjoying it. It's all a bonus. He's had such a great year already. And it's terrifying for everyone else.
That's actually quite a good way of putting it. I was commentating on it, and I was thinking, you know, what must other players be thinking when they come up against him? There was a moment for Isner, I think, after about three games of the match. He'd had two service games, and he was already shaking his head, as if he actually held on to his serve. He was leading 2-1, but you could see in his eyes, I don't really know what to do again. I'm doing what I do. I'm absolutely marmalising serves and hitting everything I can as hard as I can. And it wasn't doing much.
Yeah, I mean, I think Djokovic is rebuilding that aura that he had a couple of years ago or a few years ago, where, you know, even on a stage like this, amongst the top eight players, he was winning matches before taking to the court. I think he went through a really rocky period, there's no doubt. Had the surgery at the start of the year, but mentally and physically in that period, he was, you know, pretty far from his best. And I think he's now back on it mentally, and he's rebuilt his kind of physical fitness. Obviously, Marin Vida's come back into the team. Gebhard Fjellgrits has come back in as, you know, his fitness trainer, and he's putting the work in again. And he seems to have that kind of, I almost think it's like an inner zen, where he just sort of centres himself in big moments and big matches, and you just think, well, nothing's going to sort of knock him off his perch here. He's so calm and composed and relentless in his competitiveness once he's mentally there again. So he's getting close to having that aura again.
Based on what you've seen today from Alexander Zverev and Marin Cilic as well, but can you see, is there anybody obvious that you think might stop Djokovic here?
Not in the group stage, I wouldn't say. And I think it's interesting about getting the aura back, because I think in a way he's almost more dangerous now, because I feel like he's had that, you know, period away, and he's rediscovered the love for the game, and it feels like that's even more powerful somehow. You know, I feel on some level he had to have at some point. You can't, even he couldn't have that relentless intensity, but now he's had that. He's come back recharged, and he looks even more fired up than ever. And so, you compare that with, you know, just the mental side, let alone the forehands and backhands, with what we saw from Zverev and Cilic, two players who, in their own way today, look pretty frail, pretty flaky. The idea of them really going toe-to-toe with Djokovic, I just don't see it, really.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Cilic can play any better than he did in Paris.
Yeah.
He played an incredible first set and didn't play bad in the remaining two sets, and Djokovic just wore him down. So it's, you know, it's a tough ask. Conditions suit him down to a T, you know, here at the O2. Yeah, tough to see anyone stopping him, certainly in the group, but I think this week it would be a significant upset if he doesn't win it.
Well, what's going on with Marin Cilic at the moment when he's ahead? Because it's becoming a recurring theme now. I've got Grand Matt here with us, who no doubt can reel off the exact details of how many times he's been ahead and let it slip. I mean, it's a few, isn't it, Matt?
There's an awful lot. There was the two-set lead against Payer at Wimbledon, going back that far. Then more recently we've had, He let a set and a break lead slip against Nishikori at the US Open. We've had, he squandered match points against Jarry in Shanghai or Beijing somewhere. As Colin mentioned, he was a break up in that deciding set against Djokovic in Paris. Today, he wasn't in a position necessarily to win the match, but he was ahead in the first set, should have been a double break up. And yeah, he just fell to pieces. And when Cilic goes off a bit, it's so obvious, because he just racks up errors, and there's no real way of hiding it. The match just sort of runs away from him.
Do you think that those are bona fide sort of chokes He was 5-2 up today in the first set. 3-love up, 5-2 up.
Then and a breakup in the second as well.
A breakup in the second. What do you make of it?
Well, it is now becoming a bit of an issue for him. I agree with that in some of those matches in Asia, which I watched where he struggled. I think a significant one that I would mention would be the Davis Cup tie against America, where I think that really hurt him. You know, set up on query, 6-1 up in the second set, tiebreak, lost it, went on to lose the match at home to query on clay, you know, in front of his fans, where he's, you know, the big guy, the number one. I think that hurt him, and that probably played on his mind in Asia. And then the more times it happens, the more it becomes a bit of an issue. And again today, 5-2. You know, there's no doubt you can kind of put your poker face on it, but you know that'll be annoying him when he gets back to his locker room after the match. I'm sure it's on his mind, and then the more it's on your mind, the more it can happen. So it's a difficult period for him. He did play incredibly well in Paris. I thought he was really, really good.
You tennis players taking the positives out of the fact that he played well, even though he didn't win?
Yeah, I think.
Is that what you've basically
got? I guess what I'm saying
do?
Is, yeah, I mean, he's going through an incredibly difficult patch, closing out sets, closing out matches, but in between it all, played, you know, a very good level. I'm thinking back, I think it was 2014 he won the US Open, where I've never seen Cilic play like it, where he was just complete belief in all his shots, the forehand in particular, where it just looked like he could go all out on it and not miss it. Usually that's the wing where you think, well, he's, when it gets to the tight moment, is that the one that's just going to maybe just let him down once or twice? And in Paris against Djokovic in that first set, I thought, that's like 2014 US Open again. But then it just, you know, Djokovic did what Djokovic does, wore him down. So he's played really good tennis in this recent period, but he has had a few difficult moments, shall we say. So see how the rest of this tournament plays out. And then something to keep an eye on in that Davis Cup final for sure.
Now, when that match was going on, I sent Charlie here a text, a challenge. I said, I want you to go and find out from Marin Cilic what's going on. How did you get on that, Charlie?
Well, I asked him, and he basically said he needs to be more focused, you know, in those moments, which I thought was a slightly strange response, because as an outsider, I don't know how you feel about this, Colin, but it feels like he's thinking about it too much. You know, it feels like he's very conscious of the fact that he's, you know, the cliche of playing every point the same and all of that. It doesn't look like he's doing that at all. It looks like he's very aware of the fact that he's got a lead. And, you know, talk about the poker face. He's got the ball bouncing, which is almost like, you know, laying his hands out on the table. It's so, his cards on the table, I should say, it's so clear, you know, when he does get tight and he starts moving in a certain way. And I don't know, it feels like his opponents can sense that. I would say with him, it's interesting, if you cast your minds back to 2016 and he had a similar issue. Remember, he missed the match points against Federer. He lost the Davis Cup final from two sets up against Juan Martín Del Potro. To give him his due, and we were saying similar things then, the following year he got to the Wimbledon final. I know it didn't end that well. And then the Australian Open final 6 months later. So he, two ways of looking at that. You know, this isn't the first time he's had these issues, but also he has responded fairly well in the past. And you know, it'll be interesting now to see how he does. You know, can he dig himself out of this hole, or does it just become something that defines him?
Can you remember being on the court yourself in doubles? I mean, I remember a couple of the Davis Cup ties. I think I even remember one of them maybe in Umag, when you were playing really well and then you get in sight of victory and it changes. The sort of conviction about a player, you can tell when someone's tight. I'll never forget the look in Grigor Dimitrov's eyes a year ago when he was closing in on victory here, you know, and you could see him basically rolling serves and just trying to get over the line somehow.
Yeah, I think, like, I remember that match in Umag, and yeah, I think it was the end of the third set. I got really tight. I remember that. I was playing well, and I just remember there's this mad Croatian guy on that baseline where I was serving from. We had like a foghorn. I don't know if you remember that. It's like, I don't know what it was. It's the loudest thing. And then suddenly, that moment, that's all I could hear in my head. And I'm just like, you know, burning up. I think the other factor there, and actually that one in Umag, is throughout the week, I wasn't really feeling 100%. I think I was feeling a little bit sick. And as the match went on, it was a really hot day. And I just started to have a little doubt, like, I'm feeling a bit tired here. And then I think that made me nervous to try and finish it in three. Yeah. And obviously we ended up losing that set, and there was a bit of I wouldn't say panic, because obviously I kept it together. We ended up winning four, but there was a bit of worry setting. And then, but thankfully, sort of calmed it down, and we got over the line in four. Because, you know, two sets up, that's the other thing. In a team event, you think, well, we're two sets up here. If we lose this, it's a disaster. We let everyone down. I'm feeling a bit knackered here. I don't want to, you know, look tired in a doubles match. Yeah. And things. All these things go through your head. So it was that was a tough moment. But, look, to go back to Cilic, tough moment, yes. When the dust settles on 2018, Australian Open finalist, Queen's winner, could be Davis Cup winner, qualified for the O2, top eight in the world. You know, I'm not going to lose sleep over Cilic's worries. You know, he's had a pretty special year again.
He has, hasn't he? Zverev was playing terribly at the start. He was three love down, as we said, and he was constantly chattering in the direction of Ivan Lendl. He wanted to have it out about what was going wrong. I asked him after... We don't get much out of these players, honestly. I asked him afterwards, what were you saying to Ivan Lendl when or to your coaching team when you were, it was constant, really, after every point. He wasn't having it. He said, oh, I don't remember what I was saying. It worked out in the end, didn't it? It's basically what he said. I mean, I like Zverev in the interview room. I don't know him at all. I've not interviewed him on a one-to-one basis, but my goodness, he just tells you how he sees it. And whether you like it or not, he's going to tell you what he thinks. He might sometimes come across even as a bit rude, frankly, to us in the media. I don't care. That's fine. And today, he reiterated his point that he is not playing Davis Cup Finals next year if they hold it in November. And he said, I don't think any of the top players, maybe Rafa, will play. But he says, I think very, very few of them will play.
He also did that thing that he likes to do of saying, as I've said before, or, you know, I've said all this kind of, you know, he likes to make the point that, you know, he doesn't like answering the same question twice, which unfortunately is the life of a tennis player. He's punchy. He doesn't suffer fools gladly. He just says it how it is. And yeah, it's great for us, I think, observing it. And he is going to rub people up the wrong way. I think he'll be, if and when he emerges as a Grand Slam champion or someone who dominates the game, I don't think he'll be universally loved in the way that, say, a Federer or Nadal is. I think he will be more divisive than that. But yeah, that's no bad thing. But playing-wise today, I mean, really ropey first set.
Yeah. Well, what do you make of him as a player? Obviously, he's a very, very good player. He's here, second year in a row, and he didn't go to the next gen, which he could have gone to the last 2 years. And yet you still have this question mark over him at Slams because he hasn't... I think he's reached one quarter-final so far.
And got hammered in that.
Do you see an issue there? Given what he's doing everywhere else, do you see much of an issue there, Colin?
I don't think he's maximising his potential in the way he's playing a little bit. I was kind of fascinated.
Why not?
I was just fascinated to watch him at the Laver Cup. I don't know if you guys watched that, but that moment where Federer was sort of leaning over the bench and giving him a good, you know, minute, a couple of minutes of advice and staying close to the baseline and looking to dictate points, not fall back too much. And just felt like Zverev was a little bit glazed over,
even though it was Federer.
Well, exactly.
We've been asking him about whether Lendl has been telling him to do that, given obviously what he did with Andy. Mm. And Zverev's not having it. He's saying, look, I've got these big swings, I need more time.
Well, that's it. And I think, but I do think Lendl will prove to be a good appointment for him. I think, you know, if anyone's going to sort of get the message across, then it's probably going to be Lendl. You know, although Federer is Federer and incredible, he's still sort of on the tour, he's still a competitor, right, of Zverev. So it's maybe a little bit, he doesn't want to seem like he's taking that advice, perhaps. But I think Lendl could prove to be an inspired appointment. I think he needs to step up a little bit. He's not going to be a Federer like taking every ball on the rise, and because he does have, you know, the bigger swings, especially in the forehand. He doesn't really adjust the forehand take back regardless of the shot that's coming in there. So that's where sometimes I think he struggles if it's a fast ball or a really low ball. He still takes the racket back up quite high and likes to then wind it up from there. So, but I have seen him at times really dictate when he's confident. But you've got to be timing the ball really well if you've got that bigger swing. So he's not going to be a Federer sort of right on top of the baseline taking it early, but I do think he just needs to, you know, tip the balance a little bit more towards dictating opponents, especially in bigger moments. But there's no doubt there's a game there that's capable of, you know, special things in the sport, and he's got a mentality as well where he thinks he's destined for that. So that counts for a lot as well when you're going into these moments, and I think he'll chip away at that Grand Slam, you know, trouble, if you like, that he's had, and eventually, you know, we'll see him in semis and finals and you know, probably win one day.
But that's what really intrigues me about it. You know, he does give off that impression that he feels he is destined to win one. And he also, he's very dismissive of the fact that he hasn't got such a good Grand Slam record. And I'd love to know whether he genuinely just isn't worried. You know, he's very calm, very self-assured that it will come eventually. Or it's a slight, you know, not wanting to show that maybe he does have more anxiety. And you know, he's probably at the extreme end of that. I think some players maybe give away too much after defeats. You know, they are so clearly hurt by them. But I do think if he is just, you know, very relaxed, it's going to happen, it's going to come, that's fine. But it does feel like maybe he needs to take on some of the lessons from this last year. And hopefully he will. And hopefully, you know, behind the scenes he is. But like, you know, the French Open where he did reach that quarterfinal, but he was absolutely exhausted by the time he did, and he basically couldn't move by the end, and team destroyed him. And he'd gone through these really tough five setters. And I think the question was justifiably asked, you know, can you keep doing this? Can, you know, this is going to catch up with you. And again, he was quite dismissive of that. He was like, why aren't you, you know, just praising me for winning these tough five-set matches? And I think the reason is that people have high expectations for him. And if you're going to be a Grand Slam champion, you can't be doing that. You can't go through a whole tournament with having lapses for a set or two, because it will catch up with you. And that's what happened to him.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This lukewarm response of yours to tonight's entertainment, Colin, is it due to what you witnessed last week in Milan? You seem to be the only person that I've come across so far that likes these short sets. Explain
well,
yourself.
I just want to clarify, lukewarm, you know, I said it was good. I didn't say it was, you know, average, which lukewarm feels kind of average to poor to me, but it was good. Mm. Don't get me wrong. Like I said, the show is spectacular.
Yeah.
And they do an incredible job of that in a special arena. And we watched one of the best players ever, you know, do his stuff to a very high level. It was a good show. Could it have been better? Look, possibly. I think I'm probably influenced by having been in Milan all last week and commentated on the majority of matches, and especially...
What do you like about it? Why are you four? It's first of four, isn't it? And then tiebreak at 3-3?
Best of five, first of four games, tiebreak at 3-3, yeah. Mm. With so many other, you know, no ad and no lets, everything thrown in. I just feel... Look, first of all, I want to make the point. I'm not dead set on this. I don't think we would ever see it here at the O2, at the World Tour Finals, and at the very highest level of the game. But I just feel, having been in Milan and been so entertained by it at times, and the two semi-finals were just breathtaking. You know, I commentated on both of them, so I sat there for 4.5 hours, and I walked out of that commentary booth, and I was, you know, adrenaline was pumping, and it was like so. It was just so good to watch. No downtime. I think I was sitting there in the match and I was sort of, you know, counting on my fingers the games because, you know, a little bit slow tonight. But so Djokovic breaks it at 2-2 for 3-2. And for me, the first set was over. at that moment, because, you know, okay, it's an extreme contrast in styles tonight, where you've got Isner, who really struggling against Djokovic from the back of the court, and Djokovic, you know, over his serve woes and things like that. So I felt like that set was over. So Djokovic then holds, and that would have been 4-2, right? Second set. Whereas we then sat through the next sort of four games, which were a little bit dead for me, you know? That's what I felt. And then, you know, had we been in Milan, actually, I know it would have been different because different pressures at different times. But the way the games went, we would have had a second set tiebreak, which I think, you know, with everything they could do with the lights here and the show and all that, and pump the crowd up and the decibelometer or whatever you call it and things, I think a tiebreak's really engaging for the crowd. And now we had a situation in Milan where Tsitsipas played Munar in the groups, and he was 4-3, 4-3 up, two tiebreaks. He'd won 10 more points in the match. Now, if you put that across a traditional scoring, he'd have just been, you know, a break and 2-1 up in the second, or a break and one love break up in the second, and you're sort of thinking, is it pretty obvious who's going to win here? But it's two tiebreaks, and then Munar wins the third, and you think, well, is there going to be an upset here? Even though actually over the course of the whole match, Tsitsipas completely, well, outplayed him. You know, he dominated him, as Djokovic did to Isner tonight. So I just think there's something in the format. I think there's events out there. I think I tweeted about it in the ATP 250s, where, you know, I played a lot in my career, and there's tournaments out there, and there are matches out there that take place where there's not an awful lot of interest, right? You look at other sports, and we're a global sport competing with other, you know, global sports. And, you know, before we came on air, we're bantering away about football. But football, look, football's tribal, isn't it? Where, you know, no matter how bad your team play, you turn up and you're, like, so into the match, and you cheer them on, even though, you know, they're trying passes that are flying out the pitch or whatever it is in West Brom's case.
Why? Right.
Tennis doesn't have that. So you buy your ticket, you turn up, it's two players that you might have no association with whatsoever. They're not from your country, they might even be from your continent. So what's going to engage you in that match? You know, and for me, it's big moments. It's, you know, fast-paced tennis and action, and that format just brings a little bit more of that. So if
you were,
we're not saying
there, Charlie, what did you think?
I think there was much to admire about Milan, and I think the whole, you know, just as a counterpoint to here, I thought all the kids being there every day gave it a real energy, and the players responded really well. I think on the scoring, that was, you know, some of the players said they found it very stressful. Tsitsipas used that word. Taylor Fritz was a fan. He said he thought it was great. Good
way. Definitely stressful.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And it's exhausting. You know, that's what the players talked about. The intensity is mind-blowing. They hadn't quite realised that before, because it is that feeling of, like, every point counting. But I would agree with you on the 250 point, and I did a piece last week kind of knitting all of it together. I think that would make for a more compelling tour if you did have a few events that had their own rules or did things a little differently. Because at the moment, from event to event, you basically just change surface, and that's the only real point of differentiation. But if there were the odd 250 event that had that, you know, was experimenting with a different score system or was playing, you know, sun-death juice points, I think it would just be a good way of enlivening some of those events. And, you know, if they work, then yeah, maybe you move them up to 500s, to 1000s even.
I do think, you know, there's that element of, can you play a 250 one week with that format, and then, as often happens on the tour, you're playing a 500 the next week or a 1000, and you're back to traditional
and
scoring.
And is it confusing?
Could it be confusing for the crowd and they don't... Possibly, but maybe it's engaging for a different, you know, clientele, or I don't know if that's the right word, but a different crowd that might be engaged in those events, and a younger crowd. And definitely had the feeling in Milan that, you know, very few to almost no dead games. Didn't feel like you could leave the match because you were straight into a sort of crunch moment of a juice point at love all in the third set all, and you think, this is pivotal. This is the third set, it's going to swing here, and then whoever loses it is going to win two in a row, so they're up against it. The moment with Rublev in the semi-final was one of the moments of the year for me, where he got the second time violation on the no ad point for going to the towel box, which was another feature in Milan. Didn't realise, and then to the ad side, hit 197 kilometres an hour serve out wide to win the point.
That
and
was
then
very funny.
Yeah. You know, Vicenti, his coach, is like screaming at him, like, "Are you crazy? What's going on here?" And just, yeah, it was a fun moment, and a moment that wouldn't have happened in the normal format.
Let me tell you what the tennis podcast crowd are saying. I put out there, Colin Fleming is wondering in commentary if short sets might work in the ATP 250 events. Unique selling point, better for kids with no dead time. Judy Murray says no. Right? So there's Judy Murray's verdict. Els Kronenberg says no, I hate short sets. Takes away all the tension. Jeff McMillan says horrible idea all the way around. Klaus says just as horrible as the Davis Cup new format proposal. Joe says let's just change tennis for kids. As long as the kids are happy. We put it to a poll, Colin. 900 votes, 12% of people like it, 88% against. However,
need to have 12% of the tour doing it. I mean, I think that's the point, you know, that I don't think many are saying it should become, you know, introduced across the board. But I think it's possible to have, you know, different fans appreciate different things. Mm. And not every, you know, let's face it, not every tennis fan is going to want to watch two fairly run-of-the-mill players slogging it out in a long five-set match that actually isn't that entertaining. You know, your purists might, but, you know, different fans like different things. And I think it's okay for tennis to be thinking about how we engage lots of different types of fans.
Yeah. Well, I definitely feel they're right to be trying this out.
I guess the other thing I would say is how many teenagers and young 20-somethings are using Twitter anymore? The pace that this life moves.
What are they using there?
I don't know because I'm not using it, but Instagram, Snapchat, you know.
Let's ask somebody young.
I think that's a relevant point where, you know, the things are moving on at such a pace.
Well, that's true.
Users already...
What I have against it, I mean, I know the selling points are the more frequent important moments and set-changing moments come more often. My issue with it is you don't get these ebbs and flows in a set. You don't get this chance for the tension to build. What I love about a set is the way it can, especially a set that's going 3-all, 4-all, 5-all, and then you suddenly realise just how much this set is going to mean to one of these guys and how crushing it is going to be for the guy that loses it. And I think that you feel that around the stadium. I quite like that slow build-up. Otherwise, I think you end up with a film full of endings. I want to have that build up and that narrative going all the way through. But I also realise that I am 45 years of age and I'm not necessarily the target market.
But like I say, I completely agree with you. And I think if you're sitting at the O2 and watching two of the top eight players in the world and you're already like so engaged in the match and thinking about who's going to win and how it's going to play out on your tube, you know, ride in there or whatever, and you want to see that traditional flow to the match and things. But if you're at a different event in a far-flung corner of the world and you're not that engaged with who the players are or something, do you want to see something different? You know, there's a whole spectrum of tennis that's going on out there, and I think we're right to try things. I think the point Chris Kermode makes is absolutely right, where we're in this sort of great period of tennis, and now's the time to try things. Don't wait till potentially have a little bit of a dip and then panic and start to throw things at it. You know, trial it now.
Yeah.
Maybe it doesn't work. But all I would say is, having had, you know, a week in Milan, sitting commentating on it, there were very few matches. In fact, I don't think there were any where I came away and went, that was rubbish. You know, that was, nothing happened there. No exciting moments. It wasn't engaged. You know, all of them had something. Crowd were engaged. Crowd were very young. Yes, the ATP and the Italian Federation threw a lot of the event. So if you didn't have all the, you know, the Hawkeye Live, and you didn't have all the, you know, similar sort of atmosphere to we have here, and you're on an outdoor court somewhere, and, you know, it's a bit windy, and would it be the same with no music blaring at the change of ends? Is that the same show? Of course it's not. So it's hard to say it's just the scoring format that got everyone so engaged there. But
it was also a particularly quick fight, wasn't it? Because the court was quick. So it did feel like sets were whizzing by. I mean, you had some in about 12 minutes. It was strange, you know.
What do you think about the scoring system, Matt? You're half our age, so, you know. Tell us what you think.
I think Colin's made a very compelling case. I say I didn't watch a huge amount of the Next Gen Finals, but what I did watch of it, I just think it really takes away more than it adds. As you said, David, the ebbs and flow of a set is so important, and when you've got these moments that are meant to be more important, if they come about all the time, if they come about so often, they actually lose a bit of their importance. Like a tiebreak is exciting to me because you've had such a set to get there. If suddenly you're in a tiebreak every 15 minutes, it slightly loses its edge for me. And a lot of the sets were either, as Charlie said, over in 12 minutes or a tiebreak. They just seem to be a slight lack of sort of variety, I suppose, when you've only got to get to four.
Yeah, and it's as extreme as they can get it in Milan, because they did a tiebreak at 3-3 as well instead of 4-4.
Do you like this no-ad scoring? Because you would have had that when you were playing doubles.
No, I don't like the no-ad particularly, although maybe that's counterintuitive to being, you know, a little bit in the supportive camp of that shorter format, because that creates more big moments as well, which ultimately that's the formula to make it a little bit more exciting for your big moments, creating right. more of them. As a player, I didn't particularly like it, because that for me is what creates so much of the stress, actually more than it being first of four, best of five, because every point just feels so important. You know, if you're serving at 40-30 in normal scoring, like we had in the slams, you're pretty chilled. You know, even if you miss your first serve, second serve, you think it's fine. So in that scoring, suddenly it's like, break point down, like I'm under so much pressure here every moment, like it's relentless.
And that was something actually Andrei Rublev said, kind of linked to that. He felt that it added an element of randomness having the shorter scoring and the sudden death juice points, and he quite punchily used that Jaume Munar Tsitsipas match you referenced, Colin, as an example. He said if that's normal match, then Tsitsipas is winning that easily, but because you've got this slightly random element to it, it was closer, you know, than it might have been, which I guess is great as a fan, but as a player might be quite frustrating when you feel that, you know, games are going against you that maybe you should be winning or would have won normally. And it's kind of like the match tiebreak, which I know Jamie Murray, I don't know how you felt about that, but he's spoken about feeling really hostile towards it, because you come off the court sometimes, you're like, well, how do we lose that match? That wasn't really a fair reflection of
it. I didn't mind the match tiebreak as much. I still felt like, you know, it's long enough that kind of I think the best team or the team that played the highest level won the match. I think the reason the no-ad bothered me a little bit as well in doubles is that because it changes the nature of the sport, in that you could break serve in doubles without a player winning a point on return, whereas, you know, you could have someone just light it up and win 4 points on their side, which for me is a team game. You know, you should both contribute towards that break, you know, so that was a significant change to things. So I didn't like it for the significant pressure as a player, although I can see as a fan how that created more big moments and also that kind of return element to it as well. But look, it's interesting. Do I think it's the rule I would sort of expedite quickest into the tour? Probably not. I wouldn't be going there first. I'd be looking at the shortened warm up and possibly getting rid of the warm up. I would be looking at, even if you have a warm up, for me, for example, the singles tonight is 8 p.m. so the player should be on the court at 7:50 doing the warm up and the first ball should be at 8. I just think that's so much better for fans, so much better for TV. I don't think that's a difficult thing, because you see the warm up in Milan, it didn't affect anyone. They just adjust what they do. There's a practice court as there is at the O2, like a 3-minute walk, so you can go and hit there and walk straight to the court if you want. I think there's little things like that where I'd be trying to bring them in sooner and continue to test the shortened format.
Colin Fleming, Charlie Eccleshare, it's been lovely to have you with us here on the Tennis Podcast. Quick predictions for tomorrow. Kevin Anderson against Kei Nishikori.
Ooh, tough one. They played a few times recently, haven't they? Let's have a bit of Kevin Anderson. Why not? My first reaction was Nishikori, but I think Anderson will get it done.
What are you going with, Charlie?
I think Anderson in three.
Okay. We've got doubles tomorrow. Jamie Murray and Bruno Suarez against Cabal and Farah. We're only going to ask Colin because he's the expert.
Well, there's only one answer there for me, isn't there? I think it's got to be Jamie and Bruno.
Okay. Federer against Thiem in the evening session. Are we going to get another upset?
Federer. Oh.
Federer for me,
fantastic.
Yeah.
What about you, Matt?
Yeah, full house.
Okay, all right, I'll go that as well. Fine, well, it's been lovely having you with us on the Tennis Podcast. Finally making your debut, which wasn't your debut.
Yeah, it's great. That's what happens when you're on for the second time, isn't it? It's a debut. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
So you've re-signed for the club.
And I'm going to have my second beer in a minute as well. And then we should start the sort of off-limits Tennis Podcast. Brought to you in association with The Telegraph. Executive produced by Melanie Bowes, tennisballs.com and Triple S, our mascot, you'll like this, Colin, is Charlie the Ferret. And yeah, I can see on the look on your face. And we are also sponsored by La Manga Club. We'll be back tomorrow.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.